Hello and welcome to the Shotput podcast. I'm Lucy Ireland, one of the artistic directors of Shotput, a dance theatre company based in Glasgow. In this podcast, we have conversations with people from different practices, investigating some ideas that are feeding us at the moment and that are informing our shows. We hope that this allows you to walk with us for a while, to take a moment to look at some things in the world outside. This first mini-series is all about film. It's being released in tandem with the Scottish tour of Shotput's live show, Ferguson and Barton. Ferguson and Barton was inspired by Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, and that's why we're focusing on film in this mini-series. In this episode, myself and Shotput's other artistic director, Jim Manganello, sit down to speak to Anna Clifford and Omari Carter, two of the brains behind the Motion Dance Collective, a film production company based in London that makes screen dance. We go into this forum in a lot more detail in this episode, but in a nutshell, this is how Omari has spoken about the practice. The choreography of the camera, the choreography in front of the camera, and the choreography developed through the edit. We discuss Anna and Omari's roots in hip-hop and ballet, how dance and the camera fit together, their collaboration with cinematographers and other creatives, and money, and how it affects the work we make. Some information about Omari and Anna. Omari Motion Carter is also, in addition to being a screen dance practitioner and creative director of the Motion Dance Collective, a lecturer at the London Contemporary Dance School at The Place, a choreographer and a body percussionist. He founded the MDC in 2011 and has since made many, many pieces of screen dance, served on panels, given lectures on the practice around the world. He's also an incredibly open, positive soul and a wonderful person. Anna Clifford is MDC's producer, as well as a choreographer and filmmaker in her own right. She's worked as a dancer and choreographer on stage and screen. Anna has also worked as a project coordinator for dance companies and somehow also finds time to have an extensive yoga teaching practice. My relationship with Anna goes way back. We trained together on the dance course at the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland, and it's been a real joy to see the different directions which she's gone. There's more information on how you can catch Ferguson and Barton on tour at the end of this episode. For now, here's our conversation with Omari Carter and Anna Clifford of the Motion Dance Collective.
Hello, Anna and Omari. It's so good to have you.
Thank you so much for having us. We're really excited to talk with you.
We were watching a lot of your materials, which are, it's just so good to go back through what you do. These screen dance pieces, these pieces of screen dance, I receive them almost like little poems.
I love that interpretation. I don't think we've ever heard that before. I mean, obviously, Omari is super connected to rhyme, especially with his recent academic work and many of the films we've made in the past. But I've never heard it screen dance described as little poems. I really love that.
Yeah, I think it's when you think about the film industry in general as well, a lot of people write their shorts first, right? Their little poems first, and then in the hope that one day those poems could potentially culminate into the book, right? In some ways, it's like chapters, you're just trying to get some pieces down, and then at some point, all of these little ditties of writing that you've done can come together into something more fully formed.
The book, the feature film.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, do you feel that way? Do you feel that these are sketches or stories leading towards a feature?
Definitely with some of them. I think some of the shorts are part of a bigger series in our minds, I would say. And then others just are individual, have their own lifespan. But I think many of the shorts we've made range in length, you know, from like 5 to 15 minutes.
What I hear from a lot of filmmakers is they say there's always a shorter version.
Yes.
At the same time. And I think what we've done is we've gotten really well at short form screen dance. It's a practice. It's a way of making. It's, and even with poetry, it's a way of writing. But then when you get to maybe like feature films or even writing for academia, it's a different type of writing. So you have to be able to shift to that new way of writing. So as much as we are excited about making a feature film, it involves a different practice.
Do you have like a feature film in mind that you would want
to
make?
Yeah, and we are not going to tell you about it. In case someone hears our idea and tries to make it before us.
It could have been an exclusive on our podcast.
I think when we think about it, the challenge is, can we make a film with no words that is feature length? And how do you hold attention with that being the through line of it all? But then you've got places like DV8, for example, is such a big example of works without words that can grab attention for a test of time.
A long period of time, yeah. Absolutely.
So I think they were our huge inspirations for me in particular when thinking about what I want to achieve in the future. But to have the privilege to get the time to do that is something that we're hoping for.
But I suspect too that the brevity of your films is a challenge in its own way as well. Like it would...
Yes.
I don't know if you have this experience, but more and more when we're in the rehearsal room, and I suppose we usually are making like hour long pieces, so somewhere in between short and long. Mm-hmm. But my impulse when we watch our videos back is like, God, I just want to cut all the fat.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's like with anything, exactly what you say, cutting the fat. You can be watching something for 1 minute and be bored, or you could be watching something for an hour and a half and be enthralled.
And we all know theatrical time is different from film time in terms of how much we can hold attention.
Very much.
So you find that more in digital work. And I guess we're also conditioned in that way to get these short bursts of information and be able to read them quickly with digital. Mm-hmm. But you start to go, oh yeah, I need to, what do we call it? Killing the baby. It's such a harsh term, but it is your baby. And it's really hard to cut the material when you love all of it.
Yes. Right? Well, especially when you're in the editing process and it's really hard to let go of things that you're attached to for whatever reason.
Yeah, whether you were at the shoot, you knew it took 3 hours to get, you finally got it throughout the rain, and then you realize you don't need it.
You don't actually,
Wow, it's just a theory.
Yeah, that's so hard.
When you say you don't need that, is that an impulse or is it more collated to, I don't know, an idea about story structure or something that's more analytical?
Yeah, it depends on the process of the film. If it's got a very strict narrative structure, then half of the time we're pretty much keeping it as it is most of the time. But sometimes you also get those pieces that maybe the choreographer doesn't know exactly how it will be put together later on. It may be something a bit more improvisational.
Yeah.
Something maybe a bit more abstract, where you've gone to a space, you had 3 hours and you got pieces of your puzzle, and then you're taking it to the editing room to shape it. There's a lot more of don't need that, like that, and trying and testing.
Absolutely. Mm. So Fractured Frames, one of our recent films that we sent you, I didn't know what the edit was going to look like when we shot that. I had created scenes of movement and intention, and we shot them in the way that I wanted them to be shot. Mm. But then when it came to the edit, Omari and I very much sat down and were like, how do we put this together?
Since we're on to specific films, can you tell us a little bit about Fractured Frames? Okay, I just saw it, but
of course,
expand on it.
So Fractured Frames was actually the second iteration of a film I made in college about the body, and it was a solo work, and it was my first exploration of choreography, I would say, the first year of exploring my style of choreography. And I always knew that I wanted to revisit that concept, and so I kept it very abstract because that just is how my brain works in a more artistic way. When I'm choreographing, I don't often follow a strict structure. I just start with emotion and follow where that intention leads. So with Fractured Frames, I worked with this amazing dancer, Alice, who is a very intuitive mover, which is why I wanted her for the role. And we just worked in the studio for a long time. We started with improvisations. I got inspired by the way she moved. And then we set some choreography, made some phrases. And then I had this narrative structure in my head of what I wanted to say with the movement, what I wanted to say with the work. But like we said, I had no idea what it was going to look like at the end. And we also didn't have any music until after the edit was finished. So that was really interesting too, because normally when I choreograph to music, Whereas this time around, I did it in reverse, which was a really interesting experience. And I really enjoyed it because the movement was just so much more, it felt like it was coming from inside instead of an external inspiration, if that makes sense.
Did you have any music in mind or?
I think I had a vibe in mind, which I definitely sent some like reference tracks to the composer and some intentions. And especially for certain parts of the choreography, I was like, I'd really like crescendo here or the strings here or whatever it was that I had in my head. But she's such an incredible musician that I very much gave her free rein. And we went back and forth. I think she sent me maybe three drafts.
Nicola.
Yeah, it was Nicola. Nicola Chang is fabulous. And we went back and forth with the music, and I just gave some feedback. She did a few tweaks here and there. I didn't want to dictate too much of what she was creating, but at the same time, it needed to connect with the film. So,
and you talk about Fractured Frame started with the movement first.
Dance film?
Is that always the process?
It's a good question. Not always.
No. Yeah, it always kind of shifts. I guess even with me coming from a hip hop background, it was always music first. But then learning how to work in this way that we did with Fractured Frames is definitely more of a Hollywood film way. You know, you make the piece, then you send it to the orchestra and they record it over the top, the mood music, you could say, for some pieces. Yeah, working that way, I definitely am excited about. But sometimes it might start from poetry, for working with a poet, or it may start with Katrina McPherson in her book, Making Video Dance, calls this starting point a formal starting point, which where you start from the technology, or the camera's always moving forwards. That's our starting point. Now what happens to the choreography based on that?
And I think for our work in general, what would you say was our most common order of events when it comes to our process? I think we've done it so many different ways now, which has always been a great learning experience. But I think we're probably inspired by concept first and foremost, and then build from there, right?
I think so. I like narratives.
Yeah.
I definitely am comfortable with trying to find at least a beginning and middle with something.
Yeah.
But that also kind of stemmed from what I see from a lot of the hip hop dance community on screen now is a lot of just, you know, freestyling spectacle battles and things like this for the camera, for the audience. So for me, it was always something that I wanted to try and break those bodies out of that pattern and try and tell more stories with those particular bodies.
I mean, it's really interesting to hear the different initiators in the process, whether it's another choreographer or a choreographic idea or a story. So it's really clear that those shift. And I think that this is something that film is just so inherently, it's not even that it's good at it, it's constitutive to the form. And I very much feel like that's bled back into a lot of theatrical processes. Like, film has inspired us to think about how a piece of performance can be like woven together rather than just staged, if that makes sense. Sorry, there is a question at the end of this, which is, are there any processes that you keep going back to in order to maintain that North Star, i.e. storyboarding or scripting or certain collaborative conversations?
Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah, I think you mentioned like two of the kind of same things that we like to use, and what I would say, templates.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, I love a template. So our scripts, right? When we write scripts, everyone uses a different program, or do I have a certain template that they use? Your storyboards, right? Once you've got your storyboard template, you're using that same template for every single piece. Our shooting schedule, right? We use a certain app for that. So every piece we always go through the same process of working our way through these templates, right? And whether that's the call sheet, right?
Yeah.
Whether that, all these admin things, right? Our proposals, you know? So I think for us, I feel like we've gotten more efficient by having these strategies of our templates in place. And we always kind of just work through those regardless of what the process is, right? Mm-hmm. These things need to happen.
Yeah.
Do you feel like having that kind of like strict template restricts you in any way? Or do you feel because it's there, you can then go off and explore many things?
Yeah, I think all the templates that Omari is talking about, they're all very like, we're talking bare bones. This is what we need to make this happen. So to have those templates in our, you know, treasure chest, as it were, it means that when we get to each stage of the process, we know we can go here and use this. And we know that it works because it's tried and tested, you know?
Yeah, you need to put those boundaries in place to know that you can play within a remit, right? So, I think they're important. And that's why I really love them, because also we always say they stay alive, right? The budget is always changing. You may have your budget template, but it's living, right? Every single day, something's going to happen and something's going to change within that. And that involves creativity within itself. So all of that kind of comes into one. But once you've got that in place, you can be creative and free and perhaps even innovative, knowing what boundaries you have to work with, you know?
The templates help us be more efficient in the way that we work as a team and in the way that we infiltrate our process with every team that we work with.
Do you think that these templates, these restrictions are... would you say that this is one of the dividing lines between live performance in your experience and film? Or do you feel like this is something that crosses both of them? Because we don't have shot lists, for example. On a shot production, it's just not there.
But you'd have your script.
Well, we don't.
Oh, you don't? Oh, right.
They specifically maybe don't have a script. But I think that some of them very much cross over. To go back to the question, like, I think our initial answer is definitely...
Oh, 100%.
The answer is yes. A lot of them cross over. And I think a lot of artists use some element of what we've been talking about, some element of a template, some element of...
Organizing
your ideas, your thoughts.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a lot of crossover in the way that all creative industries work, but they just give different names to everything.
Yeah.
So it's like one speaking French, one speaking Spanish, but we're saying the same thing.
Because like you said, you might not use a shot list, but you use like lighting cues. You know, you might not use a storyboard in the same sense.
Your scene breakdown.
But you have, yeah. So there's like just a different essence, but it's essentially the same thing.
So can you tell us a little bit about your journeys as artists? And I don't mean to make it sound like it's only unidirectional.
No, for sure. Yeah. You go first.
Yeah. I started off as a hip hop dance practitioner. Dancing, I like to say dancers of hip hop culture rather than specific styles, but I love all of them. But I started off doing that and doing backing dancing and choreography for music videos and adverts. And I absolutely hated it. And the reason I hated it is that I realized there was a gap between the filmmaking side of things and the choreographic side of things and the dance side of things. They weren't, the production meetings were separate, right? We would arrive on set sometimes and not know what angle we're being shot at or what the storyboard was. Or they wouldn't realize that we needed a 5-minute warm-up before we started doing some of these moves that we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized that there wasn't really a conversation between the art forms that they were capturing in some way. So from then I was doing my degree in performing arts at London Metropolitan University, studying contemporary dance there. That got me in my contemporary dance world. While I was doing that, I got my first music video that was dance specific. It was by a group called Stanton Warriors, who are kind of a production group. So they weren't in the video, it was just dancers in the video. And so from then I realized that you could have a conversation. They were giving me certain rigs and asking me what I wanted to do with these rigs. And I'd never been thrusted between, you know,
you've never
over
been
that
allowed
line.
Inside the process before
right.
then. Yeah.
And so I said, well, I want to do this only from now on. And
sorry,
then I realized,
can you say they were giving you certain rigs, did you say?
Camera rigs.
They
were putting me on a dolly and the dolly would slide and I would be standing on it and then they'd ask me what I could do with it. Or they put me on this rig, I call it the Professor Green rig or the Justin Timberlake rig, where the camera is mounted to you. And so then you have all these boundaries and restrictions to play with. So yeah, I said I want to make work like this, where this conversation is happening between the dancers and the filmmakers. And so I realized there was a whole world out there that was doing that. And that was the screen dance industry. And just recently completed the master's in screen dance at London Contemporary Dance School, and lecturing there now in all things dance, film and hip hop culture. So
before you go, Anna, I just want to ask a little. So you talk about Omari, like you've been in music videos and then into screen dance. Is there a difference between the two? They both involve film, music, dancing.
So with screen dance, I would say that screen dance as a term is the umbrella term for any type of dance on any type of screen. So that includes music video, that includes TikTok, that includes Vimeo, that includes VR, 360, you know, all of these things where we may encounter dance on a screen. But within that, you have dance film, you have, people will say video dance is another practice. You have
Dance for camera
and dance adverts and music video. So all of those kind of come within the umbrella of screen dance.
Can I ask an ignorant question to distinguish between dance film, video dance, and dance for camera?
No, it's absolutely fine.
Can I just say before you answer this question, because he's going to give you a very great explanation for this, but this was one of the main reasons we started our podcast, because this amazing conversation around definition of what do all of these terms mean, because a lot of them are interchangeable. Some people interchange them, whereas in some cases they are very specific.
And we should say, we can plug your podcast now.
Yes, our podcast, The MDC Talks, all things screen dance.
So what was the question? Oh, yeah.
The
so
question was the difference between the terms that we were listing. Yeah.
You have the mother of screen dance, they call her, Maya Deren. When she was making work, her work was termed choreo cinema. Video, that was around 1940s. I would say it was when Maya Deren was prolific making work. And then you had Katrina McPherson, Scottish-based artist, was the person who termed, was using the term video dance. And video dance was very much so more integrating the camera within the practice of the work. So you'd see Katrina on stage with the dancers, with the camera, doing live feeds and integrating the camera into the improvisation of the dancers as another dancer, you know. So it was a bit more around video art-based practices. Screen dance is not a term used everywhere in the world. A lot of people just say dance film.
Mm-hmm.
But when I think of dance film, I'm thinking a bit more of a cinematic practice potentially. I think of like Step Up for me is a dance film, where something maybe like Fractured Frames is probably a bit more of a video dance, because it's a little bit more abstract out there, and it's incorporating the camera into that work in some way. So yeah, I think within those practices come different values and ways of actually making the work and thinking about the making of the work. So yeah, I think there are a lot of arguments and discussions still about the delineations of it, and even the people who have written books about screen dance don't like the term that much.
Yeah,
but for me, I love using screen dance as the umbrella term for everything, but also as a way of thinking about the practice of the form. So it's not a film and it's not a dance. We are breaking down these languages to find a new common language that can arguably be termed screen dance practice.
Do you feel like when you that you are working within one of those categories more often or not? I mean, I suppose you just distinguish between two films, so perhaps the answer is no.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a float between them. I think there's kind of understanding whether we're being a bit more radical with it, because there's some films maybe where dance isn't involved as heavily, and we're a bit heavier on maybe the filmic side of things and looking more at the cinematography. Or there's, you know, the other way around, where it's very dance orientated, and now we're just kind of trying to merge the film process into that process that has already been quite a theatrical one.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, yes.
Go on, Anna.
Introduce myself. So I started dancing from a really young age. I started when I was 5 years old and then went to university in Scotland for dance, which is how I met the lovely Lucy. We were on the same course. And honestly, I didn't know what screen dance was until I met Omari. So I was very much in the ballet world and then the contemporary world, the neoclassical world, just auditioning as a dancer, performing as a dancer. I moved to New York for a year to train and work at Joffrey Ballet School. And then after that, I moved to London and was just auditioning, finding my way, you know, in the circuit here. And then I met Omari actually pretty quickly after I moved here because we happened to work at the same place. When he was performing in Stomp, I got a job as an usher at that theater, which is how we met. And he basically at that time was already making dance film, and he'd already made a number of films with his company, the Motion Dance Collective, at that point. And he was just kind of like, this is what I do. He found out I was a dancer. So we started talking and we were, you know, with the intention of making a project together. And he just introduced me to this whole world that I didn't really know existed. And I was just kind of, you know, taken by it. And then very quickly got involved with some of his projects. And then the rest is history.
I feel like I should know this about both of you, but I'm realizing that there's a gap in my knowledge, whether before you were working in screen dance, were you being the creator of a project? Was your introduction to being a creative of the project screen dance itself, or was that something you were doing before you were making screen dance?
I think we were both choreographing on different projects. Mm. Omari was working a lot in the music video industry, like he was saying before, choreographing for it and performing in it.
Yeah, and I was doing a lot of street dance theater at Young Actors Theater Islington, which is an acting agency that I used to go to. So I was doing a lot of long form
dance performances
yeah. with them, filming it, editing it. I guess that was like my introduction to screen dance, but I didn't realize
editing,
it was.
Yeah, editing those performances together. And I definitely was choreographing before I was making dance film, but for live work.
I got Stomp 4 months after finishing university. So for me, it was, I can't like start my company now and do, because I've got this full-time gig, so how can I keep making work? And so film really fell into my lap in terms of being able to be flexible around my full-time.
And just exercise company. Your artist on the side of performing however many shows a week you had to do, right? Like, and a lot of the, because when I met him, obviously he was still working full-time in that show, but he had, I don't know how many films you made at that point, but he had all of these films that he'd made over the years, and they were all so unique, and I was just like, wow, okay, so this is really cool, because he's, in my eyes, he was like living the dream, performing, and also like creating in his own way, you know, his own work at the same time, which I just thought, well, this is an amazing way to do that.
And when you're making your films, are you always the same role within each other's work, or does that differ?
I think we've kind of found where we want to be now. Over the years, we have definitely discovered our strengths and how we work best as a team. So I would say now Omari directs mainly and edits.
Yeah, it's like we had a go at doing everything. I feel like I definitely delved into doing as much of the different roles as possible. So now when I direct them, I feel like I can speak a few different
it's
languages.
It's the best way to learn.
But I also now know my preferences.
Mm-hmm.
The third core member of our team is James Williams, and he's our main cinematographer. And so when opportunities come to that, we let James, director of photography, up that whole thing. Because that's his thing, that's what he loves to do. So then we find roles within that. But if James needs me to operate at any point, then I'll operate.
I think we've all done multiple roles for sure. You definitely the most, because you started literally doing everything himself before he had a team. And then when I joined in, I think I very much started on the dancing side, being in front of the camera mainly. That was like our first few projects together, choreography and dancing in front of the camera. And then I got really interested in all of the roles behind the camera. So now I'm producing, assistant directing, directing, you know.
But that's the joy of the form, is that it allows us to jump. When, if we want to be in front of the camera, we can be. And if we want to be behind it, we know how to do both. So yeah, I think that's what's kept me interested, is that it's such a lovely process to be part of something with such hybridity.
Yeah.
You mentioned James Williams, cinematographer, director of production, other missing person of Motion Dance Choir. Not missing, but missing currently right now. Yeah. what's that? I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about what that creative collaboration is like, and whether it, I assume it changes from project to project, but are there things that stay constant?
The same.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, James, when we met James in 2017, I think, because we met him when we met I See You. I See You was our first project together, which is another film that we made as a trio. And it was also one of our first film together, co-choreographing. Mm-hmm. And so basically, I think we met, he slid into your DMs or something.
I slid into
it. Yeah, or he...
Someone slid somewhere.
Someone slid into the DMs.
We were doing something with paint, and he had...
He'd just done a project with paint, and we were like, this guy...
And I was like, ooh, what was that paint you used? And then, would you be interested in meeting
up? Was
this
code? Were you really interested in it?
But he was already, filmmaking and operating, and so we invited him to collaborate on this project with us, and it was great. And I think we instantly clicked, all three of us. And so from that point on, we started working with him more and more. And then eventually he became an integral part of the team, and we couldn't imagine working without him. Now it's very much like when we don't get to work with James, it feels like an arm is missing. When you click with someone creatively, that's an incredible asset to have on a project. And it's something that we wanted to just hold on to, and we didn't really see where it was going. We were all freelance, and so we weren't sure if it was something that we could carry on, but we just sort of approached him at some stage in our relationship and we're like, let's do this.
So what's the process? You can talk to me a little bit like I'm an idiot, because I am in terms of filmmaking. Is this a talking thing, or do you all arrive on set and it's just like, okay, here we go?
Oh gosh, no, lots of talking beforehand.
Lots of talking. Because the first thing we want to do is say, this is how we work, right? And then tell us a little bit about how you work, because everyone's going to come from a different space and background. And we like to do things that bridge the gap between the two practices, which may not be comfortable for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we're trying to integrate it more. We still haven't managed to fully
The two
do it
practices
yet,
but... being film and dance.
Yes, right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And so... what we try and do is I started to want to do warm-ups with the crew, right?
Physical
warm-ups,
before
we started the shoot, just to bring everyone together. You're going to be holding the camera for this amount of time, so let's all just circle our shoulders together for a second, right? So what was happening is that the crew were unable to do it because they had to set lights, they had to rig the cameras, they had to set all of these different things. So what I did was that I wrote the warm-up into the shooting schedule. Right? So let's look at the form of film. If I take the rules of film and write my process into your rules,
then
you've got no excuse, because it's in the shooting schedule. I've given enough
time. We've given time for it to happen.
So that's little things like that is where we go, right, look, this is what we love to do. This is the way that we work. How do you work? And then we finalize that with how do we need to work for this film?
And I think just to bring it back to our core team, in terms of the roles that we've now adapted as, I guess you could say, our main hats, or our main, the ones we feel most passionate about or feel that we can excel at the most as a trio. For example, on Don't Play with Lives, which is the film we made in 2021, Omari was directing that. James was the director of photography. I was the assistant director and producer, one of the producers. We had many. And so the process of that, obviously there was a million creative meetings beforehand. The dancers were creating, we were gathering the technicians, all of the sort of nitty gritty was going on behind the scenes. James and Omari and I were breaking down shooting schedule, all those things. James was talking light, equipment, what kit was needed. It's all about pre-production for us. We relish the process of pre-production because we have found that we work best when we have this level of preparation that allows us to show up on the day and the shoot just runs as smoothly as possible. Obviously, you always have problems. Things don't go according to plan. But when you have all of these things in place, all of these templates in place, and a team that you know can problem solve together well, I think at this stage, we just feel like we know that we can work as a team. And so when things don't go according to plan and when things do go wrong, because they always do, we know how to react in a timely manner and still manage to capture everything we need.
I guess what I'm interested in too, and sorry if I'm digging, sorry
no,
if I'm
don't
like
worry.
Picking out a scab, but for example, Don't Play With Lives, which we'll talk a little bit more about, and Fractured Frames, on a really, I'm going to use a terrible word, but on
yeah,
a surface level, they look very different to one another.
Oh, 100%.
And I guess what I'm asking here is, I assume that look is born in the collaboration between you and James, but what makes those films look different? What conversations have you had with James, or what intentions have you set?
I think we're going to say the same thing, but just to, it might not be the same thing, but on a very base level, money.
Oh my goodness.
Fractured Frames was a passion project that I made with no budget, zero.
But surely you were talking about what you want. I understand these, and I know I'm being pernickety, but like
yes,
money,
no.
I understand the like collaboration, money, all the things that aren't like a talk
yes.
about what do we want from this.
Uh-huh.
But surely
okay.
you talked about what you wanted.
Oh my God, yes. So with Fractured Frames, I knew that I wanted the camera to be handheld. I knew that I wanted it to be very intimate and a lot of it to be very close to the dancer, which is why the feel of that film is entirely different from Don't Play With Lives. Obviously, Don't Play With Lives, there was more, so many different elements involved. And also many creatives, like Brooke was the choreographer and the creator of the concept, but he was also collaborating with Omari and James to create the visual of what this actually looked like on screen. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot more at play in terms of, I have this choreography and this idea, but how do we make it look its best and get the story through? Whereas in my case with Fractured Frames, it was all me. I didn't have to compromise on anything because James and I just sort of told him what I was going for and he made it happen. Whereas Don't Play With Lives was a bigger team and therefore a lot more sort of strings involved to make the puppet dance, if that makes sense.
Totally.
Yeah. And I feel like the reason that Jim is bringing up these two films and because we're interested in them both is because when we watched them, we thought a lot about film genres. So for Fractured Frames, we were like, there's like horror overtones to it.
Yes,
and for Don't
yes.
Play With Lives, it was a little bit sci-fi when they like pop into this
parallel
other
universe.
World.
Yes, absolutely.
And I suppose, do standard film genres influence the work when you're making them? Or do you think about them at all?
Maybe subconsciously. What do you think, Omari?
Yeah, I don't know necessarily if I think about film genres, more so that I think about the authenticity of what's happening in this piece kind of thing. Like, I guess if Don't Play With Lies, we knew it's not a comedy. We know that it's about knife crime and we know that it's probably going to be quite dramatic and dark. So everything is geared towards that and moving towards that. So if there is something that feels funny, we'll address it on set, right? And go, actually, that's not the right way to do it. Change the way you're doing it. So yeah, I think like there definitely is a theme to it. Anna's was definitely another dark one.
Yeah, it was very dark as well.
And the themes had to do a lot of body image and all of these sort of things and being looked at and stared at. So James was a lot more voyeuristic in that film,
mm-hmm.
In terms of looking through the forest. So all of these starting points and the way we construct the work, we then put it onto the camera, right? And go, well, can we choreograph for the camera the same way we're choreographing the dance? Then we put that on again to the edit. What makes this feel dark? What makes this feel like the character is being watched from afar,
mm-hmm.
by how we're organizing these clips? So yeah, those starting points really fuel how we develop the work throughout the different members of our team. And then James will have ideas that are specific to that. In Don't Play With Lives, for example, when we go into this otherworldly space, James wanted something to be a little bit wrong because the film is about something that's really wrong. So he broke a wine glass and he put fragments
of the glass
in front of the lens in order to make a very slight distortion in the frame. So if you look at some of those images, you'll see that maybe a shoulder might just warp a little bit. It may have another shadow of a shoulder on it. And that is just from James going, actually, this is dark, something's wrong, so let's do something to the camera physically.
To make it wrong.
And so that's how we kind of, that's why it's really hard to go, okay, what is the process? Because the process
is always fed. It's different for every single project.
By the narrative and by the story.
And do you, did you discover that when you were shooting?
It was an idea in pre-production, for sure.
Yeah, and James and I have tested it before on another shoot where we were playing with shooting through glass. And I'm pretty sure he was watching a few things online about it and other things like that. So we definitely draw from things that we're researching in our own time and our practices. So, and we like to do tests and experiments too, right? So we'll do those tests and little short pieces just to play with light for a day. And then we'll have these little ideas and things that we can bring into the work later on.
Since we've been mentioning it a few times, could you do a little synopsis, or could you introduce us to Don't Play With Lives a bit?
Yeah, totally. So Don't Play With Lives was a fantastic commission made by Dance Exchange, now known as Fabric,
yes.
Right? Which was for the Birmingham International Dance Festival. And they commissioned a fantastic choreographer by the name of Brooke Milliner, who is, first of all, a hip-hop aficionado and one of the popping champions for the UK, alongside running some of the best dance groups in the world. So it was an honour to work with him because I've always been a big fan of his. But within this project, the commissioned artists, and Brooke was one of them, got the opportunity to work with a production company. And so Brooke got the opportunity to work with us to bring his commission to reality. And the reason I bring this up is because it forged a different process than what would usually happen, where really the choreographer has as much autonomy as possible within the production process, which is very rare. And it's something that we try and push forward. How can we make that happen where the choreographer is really at the top of the food chain within the process?
Mm-hmm.
So, so the piece was, he proposed was about knife crime with not just the UK, but specifically in the Midlands as well, because the piece was about themes to do with the Midlands. So we had a trio of stories that we got off knife crime from the Midlands. And Brooke,
they were inspired by true stories.
Right, and Brooke made choreography based off of those stories in order to make a piece for young adults that would hopefully allow them to see knife crime in a different light and in a different way, and way that maybe is a call to action to do something differently.
I know a lot of theater makers will have a specific person in mind in order to aid the making. Is that a tool that you use when you're making film? Like, this is for my mother, or this is for a young person?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think it helps as well. It helps you sort of narrow your scope a bit too. And like we were talking about before, when your creativity runs away from you and you get overwhelmed by all the possibilities of what something could be, it's one of those things that you can come back to that reminds you why you're doing it and reminds you who it's for and therefore what it should be.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the time for us it's about working out who the camera is, right? Because the camera is your audience. It is the person that you're speaking to. So it's one of the first things we have to work out is actually, who is this other person in the space with us? And how are we reacting or not interacting with them? Because sometimes, and to be completely honest, the films are for me, right? Sometimes it's like, this is just what I need right now. As maybe it's catharsis,
yeah,
or another thing, but I need to get this out. And if it hits other people who've gone through the same thing, then that's a bonus. And then when you're writing the funding application or sometimes finishing the film, then you're going, oh, actually, yeah, it does actually look at mental health. It does actually look at BAME community and BIPOC and, you know, all these different things. And you start to look at the web it can weave, you know, so you can see that specificity and authenticity is something that is really important when it comes to writing applications, and it can
and
be
and just
hard.
Creating in general, like you said, you can really tell when it's not coming from a personal or from an intimate place.
Of course.
Because if it's not coming from you, then why would you do it?
I mean,
we don't make art for other people. Like, it's a natural side effect that it's for people to indulge or enjoy in, and maybe we like the feedback or the validation of the sense of an audience. But I think in general, I think it's fair to say a lot of artists don't make their work for other people. They make it for themselves and they hope that it connects with somebody else out there. And most of the time it does, because, you know, our nature is so connected that most of the things we're talking about, whether it's very specific or very general, those themes, those concepts can connect to a lot of other people.
Do you find that being on panels or judging, I'm assuming some form of competitions, or even Omari teaching at the place now, do you think it's honed your practices, or are you, it's made you like key into what you're really interested in?
Teaching in some ways, depending on how much time you're given, can be like quite a lovely process of being able to play with different ideas and things. But half the time, and all teachers will agree, sometimes you're teaching the same thing each year, you know, and it can get a bit stagnant, and you're dying to make some art to be able to practice some of these things that you're teaching. Because also some of the things that we teach and the processes that we want to play with, we don't get enough time to do a lot of those things, including the pre-production, all of these talks and conversations. Sometimes they can't happen. We don't have the time. The judging is great because, especially if it's screen dance work, we watch a lot of dance film, like more than any other type of film. So I feel like that really kind of puts you in the idea of what's out there internationally. In a very short amount of time. And then you just get to see work. You get to see what people are choosing to be in their festivals, right? And the patterns and the tropes that are appearing in a lot of different work where not many people will get a chance to do that. So that has really opened my eyes to see the patterns and the things that are regular in screen dance. And then we would hope to fill those gaps in what we're seeing.
From the little bit of judging that I have done, it's sort of like opened my eyes to this desire for everyone to be original without reinventing the wheel. So, you know, when we make work, we're always striving to be innovative and create something original, something new, something different, as is probably, you know, everyone else. But it's a way of doing that without overextending yourself to the point that it doesn't actually land or connect anymore. Too often we get hung up with this idea of trying to make something brand new. You know, it doesn't really exist anymore.
Right. Well, I was just going to say, we always talk about in our work, each show we make is kind of just a different iteration of things that we're interested in.
You're not supposed to say that.
I know. Yeah. Well, we can cut it. We don't want it.
No, I'm joking. No, I mean, 100%.
Absolutely. Which is why the arc of any artist's work is incredible to watch, because, you know, what they make is normally a reflection of themselves or a reflection of how they're feeling in that moment of their lives. And it the change that happens in people's work and the way that they approach it and the processes and just the way that it looks and it feels is
super interesting. And that's one of the things I love about when you do something like this on a podcast, or you're just having creative conversations with other artists. Like, we would always do lots of research into the artists that we had on our podcast who we admired. You know, naturally, we'd watch as much of their work as possible beforehand and just try to understand the lifespan of their work as it existed at that point in time. And I just loved watching the arc that took place over their life, because, you know, watching their first film and their most recent film, you just really get a sense of, wow, who this person is, what they like, what they don't like, what they're attracted to, what speaks to them. Mm. It's just really interesting little insight into who they are.
A film that we haven't talked about yet is Finding My Feet. And you said something in that, Omari, that stuck with me, which is, and sorry if I'm bastardizing the quote, but you talked about the bits you're not supposed to see.
Yeah.
It really came, I don't know why, but it hit me as a kind of statement of intent as well, yeah, at this moment in your career. I wonder if that's true, or if that feels like if it feels like you're using the camera or using screen dance to show the bits you're not supposed to see, or...
It's a great question.
Oh, yeah, that's such a good question. I love those bits that you're not supposed to see.
Yeah, we do.
I think, you know,
hey, this is a family podcast.
Yeah, I think because I love moving both between in front of the camera and behind the camera, when I make work, I always get fascinated with trying to break that wall between the two. And really, Finding My Feet was just a conversation with me and James in a room for like 3 hours. And that's all it needed
to be. It was a total experiment, wasn't it? Like, you, at the time, obviously for context for the film, Omari had a knee operation and was out of action. He wasn't allowed to do anything. He had just started walking when he made that film. Like, he wasn't allowed to jump. He wasn't allowed to run. He had literally just come off the crutches and was allowed to walk, which, as you can imagine, as a dancer and a physical being, is a struggle mentally, and not just physically. So I think, obviously, in the interview, you hear a lot about his journey and what he was going through and just kind of finding his way and finding his feet. But I think what I loved the most about what came out of that process was it just very much, it had this documentary feel that really just kind of clicked.
It felt very authentic. And I set a couple of rules or things that James and I would play with, but yeah, I wasn't even sure if I wanted to release it. I think I tried to edit it.
Oh yeah, that's true.
We were both trying to edit it, and I tried to do it, and I just couldn't do it.
And was that related to the trauma of, and sorry, we don't have to get into this if you don't want to, but the trauma of the injury?
Yeah, 100%. It was like,
I'm
in it still. I'm still here. I haven't left it. So it was a bit too close to home. Mm-hmm. And so James edited it the day after in one sitting, and we never changed it after his edit.
It was very raw, very authentic to how you were feeling that day and how you and James just interacted in that room. Mm-hmm. And then he just did this brilliant edit of still being in that headspace, I guess, the day after.
Yeah. And yeah, so it was really good. It was really, that was another cathartic one for myself. And it allowed me to move on from it a little bit. But then I realized that so many people were also struggling to talk about their injuries, you know, and a lot of dancers contacted me. Mm-hmm. We ended up doing a lot of different research about health of dancers and things like that. So it spurred on a lot more than I was expecting. But again, sometimes you find your audience through showing them a little bit of your true self.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it couldn't have been a theatre show. No one would have paid for it.
I don't know.
Come
see your dancer that cannot dance.
Come see the dancer that can't dance. Yeah, but it was just an interesting exploration of, okay, I'm a dancer who makes dance film, and I cannot dance right now.
but I can make a dance film about it.
So how, like, what is this film? What can I do, right? Yeah. Like, what can I do with this? You guys just tuned into instincts and went with it and trusted it. And that's what came out at the end. So right.
Sometimes that's the best way, isn't it?
It's
just
true.
Like, let it out speedily. Mm-hmm. And then.
Yeah.
We're making a new, this very week, we've just come from rehearsal. You can't even call it rehearsal, but this week we're R&Ding a new project. And the first thing we did was put a big piece of paper on the wall that says instincts on it.
Nice.
You can experiment and experiment and experiment and make and remake and recut. And in a way, I think it's analogous to the editing room process, what we do with a new creation. But it's so important to capture what those first instincts are, because very often, 2 years later, you'll look back there and you're like, it was on that board. We could have done this in a week.
We just want to end with a little fun thing.
Uh-oh.
So, Omari Motion Carter.
Yeah.
Motion in the middle. Anna, if you had one, what would yours be?
Oh, God. You know, I've never thought of this.
You got nicknames for days, though.
I have a million nicknames, but let me think. Okay. What out of my nicknames?
We put you on the spot.
Anna, Banana.
No, but it has to be cool, equally as nice as Motion.
Cool.
Anna, I have a middle name, obviously, but I don't have a tag name. Because that's very much something from the hip hop community, right?
Yeah.
Having a tag name. Like Motion was Omari's tag. Definitely, I honestly, I don't know.
We'll have to think of one.
I'll have to think on that and get back to you.
That's right. Let this be an intention that we're setting.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
Yeah.
Just like at rehearsal.
Yeah.
It's our intention for tomorrow.
Yeah, what's my tag?
Well, thank you so much. It's really great to talk to you.
Absolute pleasure. It was awesome. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks for having us. Great to see you.
That was our conversation with Omari Carter and Anna Clifford. We had a great time chatting to them. You can find some links in the description of this podcast, including the Motion Dance Collective's website and other ways to find Anna and Omari. Thank you for listening to this podcast, the first mini-series of the Shot Put podcast. This podcast was made with the generous support of Creative Scotland. It was hosted by me, Lucy Ireland, and Jim Manganello. It was edited by Sonia Kilman. Thanks, Sonia. If you would like to engage with Shot Put further, we would love to catch you on tour. You can find all Ferguson and Barton tour dates on our website, www.shotput.org. We are touring from the 17th of September to the 15th of October 2022. And some theatres where we are performing will also be screening Hitchcock's movie Vertigo, so there are many ways to engage with Shot Put and our work just now. Thanks for listening.